Reality never bites in the empire of illusion.
The storyline, which is fed through every aspect of popular culture, whether that is the political culture, whether that's the entertainment industry, whether that's the news industry, is that reality is never an impediment to what we desire.
That's journalist Chris Hedges. We talked to him today about his book, Empire of Illusion.
They deliberately chose to violate the criminal law with full knowledge they were violating the criminal law. And that is why I believe they should be prosecuted.
And that's constitutional law expert Chris Pyle talking about the Bush administration's policy of torture and what it means to our democracy. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Are you pessimistic about the future? Our economic woes, climate chaos, the capture of Washington by special interests, and a host of other nail-biting problems in the reality-based universe getting to you? Well, rather than doing something about it, why don't you just sit back? Forget your worries by watching worldwide wrestling, or a gonzo porn video, or, for that matter, a PBS marathon with Deepak Chopra on how we can all be happy if we just think happy thoughts. My guest, Pulitzer Prize winner Chris Hedges, examines the turn from reality to illusion in America in his new book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. He looks at five areas: illusion in literacy, love, wisdom, happiness, and in our idea of America. He says that the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves are a dangerous pablum that's sapping our ability to solve real problems. A former Pulitzer Prize-winning war correspondent, Hedges is also author of the best-selling book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. In Empire of Illusion, he starts out by exploring the illusion of literacy. To do so, he goes to a wrestling match in Madison Square Garden. I asked him why.
Because popular culture reflects back to us the narratives we tell about ourselves, or at least the narratives we want to believe about ourselves. And wrestling, like pornography, which I also investigated, has a kind of reach, a cultural reach, where I thought, and I think correctly, I could find out things about the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. The narrative of wrestling has changed dramatically from what it was when I was a boy. It's no longer filled with that xenophobia and, I think, undercurrent of racism, where you have this sort of blonde, blue-eyed American hero who always plays fair and stands for the American way of life, battling the Iron Sheik or the Russian bear. Now these wrestling bouts have a kind of soap opera quality to them, and that the narratives I found are far more important than the actually stylized bouts. I mean, people often say, well, how can they watch it? Don't they know that it isn't real? That's irrelevant. And these narratives are about infidelities, familial disintegration. One of the most interesting that I stumbled into sitting in a match in Madison Square Garden is about a very popular wrestler named the Heartbreak Kid. His real name is Shawn Michaels, who in the fictional narrative for the wrestling fans has been wiped out in the economic meltdown and now has to work for a ruthless capitalist, virtually enslaved to a ruthless and heartless capitalist known as J.B.
That's John Bradshaw Layfield.
Yes.
And tell us, well, first of all, explain these narratives for those in the listening audience who haven't been to a wrestling match. What does this mean? These guys aren't just pummeling it out with each other? How do these narratives get inserted into the wrestling?
Well, they're very elaborate, and they use video screens within the arena to purportedly show backstage encounters, or actual time in the ring will be taken up with the playing out of vendettas or the spinning out of narratives or arguments before the actual bout begins. So that by the time a wrestler enters the arena, there is an emotional pitch within the crowd that has been built up around the narrative itself. And, you know, one of the things that I found particularly fascinating was how wrestlers' identities could be good one week and bad the next, that the delineation between honesty and cheating was gone. In fact, everyone cheated, good or, you know, even if they were sort of considered the good wrestler, as soon as the referee's back is turned, which happens frequently, I think it is, again, a kind of belief that authority is skewed against you. Any kind of cheating, therefore, is legitimate.
And so back to that narrative you mentioned before between the Heartbreak Kid and John Bradshaw Layfield, it's fascinating to hear the dialogue between them. I mean, how does JB taunt Heartbreak Kid?
He does taunt him. I mean, that's precisely the right word. And it's, you know, that he isn't going to be able to pay for his children's college. He's completely broken. His only other option is to slide down the sort of disintegrating rings of professional wrestling until he ends up fighting in some forlorn high school gymnasium. I mean, it is really taunting him with the specter of a broken life. And the crowd is extremely emotional. The reaction is quite vociferous among the fans, who obviously can relate to the narrative being spun out before them.
You say it's the anger of class warfare, but it sounds like it's the war of the rich against the poor. Where is the illusion here?
Well, I think that where the narrative departs from reality is the ability of these wrestlers, some of whom are just unbelievably huge, to rise to the level of celebrity and to battle back against their nemesis and defeat them in the ring. And I think that's where the illusion comes in, that we are not finally captive or trapped to these socioeconomic forces that are grinding us into the ground. And, of course, it plays to the fantasy of celebrity culture itself, the idea that these were people just like us who got their shot, you know, had their sort of moment to walk on stage and live a life that, for most of us, will never happen. So I think the catharsis comes in the ability of these wrestlers to strike back against these forces. And that is an ability that most people in the arena don't have.
So what role does that catharsis play then in the larger playing out of how people participate in this culture?
Well, let's remember that this is a very profitable industry, as the entertainment industry is at a whole. And it is a kind of illusion, because whatever catharsis may be experienced in the arena, the sad reality is that these people go back to a world where unemployment is rising at monthly levels greater than in the months that followed the 1929 crash, that their homes are still in danger of being foreclosed, that they are working for wages that, especially if they're doing part-time work at places like Walmart, that keep them at the poverty level. And so the danger of that illusion is that it fails to translate the personal woes and difficulties that are suffered by especially the working class, or what was formerly the working class in this country, into social issues, into political issues. And that is a very effective way to maintain an oligarchic system that has growing disparities between the rich and the rest of us, not only the working class, but the middle class.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Chris Hedges about his latest book, Empire of Illusion: The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. So you connect this culture of celebrity, this culture of illusion that you talk about here in wrestling, in the world of wrestling, and also in other areas of this chapter. You connect that to the illusion of literacy. What's a literacy connection?
A society that primarily is informed through images and music and spectacle is a society that is easily manipulated. As we sever ourselves from a print-based culture, we are in danger of confusing how we are made to feel with knowledge, of confusing propaganda with ideology, Totalitarian societies are spectacle-based societies, and there are huge segments of the American populace that believe they are informed through images, and that is exceedingly dangerous because the people who are orchestrating and forming these images have a very specific agenda in mind, whether that is in terms of making money, whether that is appealing to illusions that we carry about ourselves, or whether that is, as we saw in the presidential campaigns, spinning out a narrative and a feel-your-pain language, which produces, in the words of Benjamin DeMott, junk politics as well as junk culture. The storyline, which is fed through every aspect of popular culture, whether that is the political culture, whether that's the entertainment industry, whether that's the news industry, is that reality is never an impediment to what we desire. That if we dig deep enough within ourselves, if we grasp our real potential, if we understand that we are truly exceptional, we can have everything that we want. And that is the core message of Oprah, of the Christian right, of Tony Robbins, of Hollywood.
Even of our politics, as you say.
And, of course, a political system that is trying to convince us that we can borrow our way back with the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history to a kind of bubble economy, to a fictitious wealth that was never really real to begin with. And I think that, you know, walking away from this book, I have come to wonder if we're not the most illusioned society in history. And illusion is very dangerous because when you cannot distinguish illusion from reality, or when you mistake illusion for reality, then every judgment that you make about your society and about your lifestyle is one that is not factually based, that's not based on the real. Illusion, you know, unlike a dream where you strive towards a dream, you live in an illusion. And the longer we continue to live in this illusion that that nothing will change, that our imperium is always going to be powerful, that we can all gain in amazing prosperity from the so-called free market and globalization, then as that chasm widens or opens between what we are actually experiencing and what we believe we are experiencing, we are unprepared psychologically, emotionally, intellectually for what befalls us. We've been essentially rendered by illusion into a state of infantilism, into a state of perpetual childishness. And so that as unemployment mounts, as unemployment insurance runs out, as people suddenly try and struggle to live on welfare for $143 a month, as they are foreclosed from their homes, as they realize that the jobs that have been shed are not coming back, that we are creating a huge underclass of maybe 15 or 20% of the populace that is unemployed, and then another probably 20, 30, maybe even 40% of people who are underemployed, meaning that they have jobs, but these jobs don't provide benefits or income that permit them to live above the poverty line. And as this reality is finally driven home, then people who have been captive to this illusion react as children always react, which is with rage and a search for a savior or a demagogue that promises revenge and moral renewal. It's not a new story in history. So that the real danger of living in a state of illusion is that we become incapable or in the face of the real problems in front of us, whether those are economic, whether those are environmental. I mean, just the simple fact that we can no longer afford our imperium, that we are borrowing at a rate of $2 billion a day and have been for the last 10 years from the Chinese in order to maintain something that we can no longer afford. I mean, these are things that we as a society have yet to confront.
Chris Hedges, in your book, Empire of Illusion, you talk about the Obama campaign, and you have a section in which you quote from a call and response between Obama and his audience during that campaign. Obama asks if we're going to look backwards or forward, and the audience says forward. Are we going to look forward with hope or backwards with fear? And the audience says hope, forward. What's wrong with this kind of talk? Where do you see the illusion in some of this?
It's empty. It's meaningless. Obama is a brand, and a brand is designed to make us feel good, in this case about our government. You know, if you look at the Obama administration, what in fact has happened? We have spent, lent, or guaranteed $12.8 trillion in taxpayer dollars to Wall Street and insolvent banks in this absurd effort to reinflate a bubble economy. And this is a tactic that at best will only forestall catastrophe and probably leave us bankrupt when we enter a period of profound crisis. The Obama administration has allocated nearly $1 trillion in defense-related spending, continued the occupation of Iraq, where military planners estimate that up to 70,000 troops will remain for the next 15 to 20 years. Of course, the war in Afghanistan has been expanded. 1,500 civilian dead this year alone. 700 civilian dead in Pakistan from cross-border bombing runs by drones since Obama took office. The restrictions imposed against workers so that they can't organize have not been lifted. Single-payer, not-for-profit healthcare for all Americans, which 50% of all physicians say they want, 80% of all members of the Democratic Party say they want, is off the table. Bush is not being prosecuted for war crimes, including the use of torture. In fact, we still torture. The secrecy laws are still in place. Habeas corpus hasn't been restored. Obama offers an image that appears individualistic and new, but it is, like all brands, a way of masking the engines of corporate power. I look at Obama as sort of the political equivalent of Benetton or Calvin Klein, where these corporations used ads to associate themselves with risque politics or even progressive politics to give their products a kind of edge. But the goal was to make us passive consumers, just like those wrestling fans, and to mistake a brand with an experience.
What about the fact that most Americans now feel that the country is on the wrong track? Are they really falling victim to these political illusions?
They do in this sense, in that they haven't grasped that they're powerless, that we live in what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls a state of inverted totalitarianism.
Yeah, explain that.
And he means by that, Wolin spells this out in his work, Democracy Incorporated, but what he means by that is that unlike classical totalitarianism, where you have a kind of demagogue or charismatic leader, inverted totalitarianism, which is just another form of totalitarianism, has a center of power that is largely anonymous. In this case, of course, the corporate state. And in inverted totalitarianism, rather than propel you, as you would in a classical totalitarian structure, towards tearing down systems and creating new systems to replace the old, you pay homage to traditional systems and iconography, to the Constitution, to electoral politics, to patriotic symbols, but you corrupt to such an extent the levers of power that they become meaningless. So when you ask about the public option, which by best estimates at least half of the country supports and more than half of the medical profession supports, it is not considered because the for-profit healthcare industry and the pharmaceuticals, I mean these big insurance companies, have the power to drive the debate. And that is just repeated over and over and over. If you take the first bailout plan, $700 billion, constituent calls across the political spectrum were 100-1 against the bailout. Some of the most, and yet it passed anyway. Why? Because Goldman Sachs and Citibank, and these powerful corporate entities that hold our political system hostage wanted it best. And so we are sitting here as corporations that quite literally have engaged in fraud. All of AIG's financial records have been seized by British authorities, are bailed out, while the people they defrauded are left to twist in the wind. Tens, if not hundreds of millions of people who month after month put their money away into 401k plans or college funds that have been destroyed. And yet there is no help for them. They've lost their jobs. They're in danger of having their houses foreclosed. Half of all bankruptcies in this country are caused by people who can't pay their medical bills. But the even more disturbing statistic is that 7 out of 10 of those people actually had insurance.
Chris Hedges, your book, Empire of Illusion, is about a lot more than just these economic issues, important as they are. You take a close look at the seamier side of American culture, at pornography, and you mine that seam for some pretty trenchant observations about pornography as a metaphor for the larger cultural breakdown. You went to Las Vegas. Tell us, what did you find when you talked to people who are involved in the pornography industry, and how did you see that as the illusion of love?
Well, somebody said I should have called it the illusion of sex rather than love.
And I'd agree.
But it is an illusion because it is, first of all, I mean, we're a pornified culture. The numbers of people estimated to use porn within the country is staggering. It's easily accessible and became accessible to the mainstream, to the middle class, once VCRs were available in living rooms. Now, of course, it's disseminated primarily through the Internet. The largest users of porn on the Internet are between 12 and 18. Pornography distributors and producers who I interviewed talked about how they quite consciously aim for the teenage audience. And porn has quite effectively fused or eroticized violence. And it's not simulated violence. And you see that from the interviews that I carried out with women who act in the porn industry. They are popping handfuls of painkillers before they go on the set. They have frequent reconstructive surgery to repair anal and vaginal tears. They are knocked around. They're black and blue by the time they finish a shoot. The first interview I did with a woman whose stage or screen name was Nadia Stiles, who had just left the industry a month before, it was clear after a few minutes I saw that sort of thousand-yard look and that hollowness or emptiness in the tone of her voice, which I recognized because I suffer from it, is post-traumatic stress disorder. These women are abused.
Now, you suffer from it because you were a war correspondent.
Right, for 20 years. So, I mean, PTSD is something I know intimately. And I brought these, I'm not a porn watcher, so I brought these DVDs home. And my wife actually did most of the transcribing of them, and they're appalling. Some of them, any listener can go online and look at things like Slut Bus, or that's where people drive around in a van and pick women up and offer to pay them if they'll let them film them having sex, and then they film them having sex and then leave them on the side of the road and hold out a wad of bills and then suddenly drive away and leave the woman unpaid, abandoned on the side of a highway. I mean, that's sort of amusing. There's many, many sites like that. And the utter cruelty of it and the level of violence, which is known as gonzo porn, was a very frightening revelation to me about how deeply commodified human beings, and especially women, have become in our culture. And I am a little stunned at the left. I begin with a quote by the great feminist Andrea Dworkin, who said the left can't have its politics and its whores too, who argue that this is a free speech issue. Well, why is the physical abuse and degradation of an immigrant worker in a sweatshop wrong, and the physical degradation and abuse of a woman in the sex industry an issue of free speech. And I end the chapter, as you know, with these men who buy these $7,500 anatomically correct silicone dolls that they go home and have sex with.
Right.
Because in the end, porn is about destroying the personality of a woman. The only emotion women in porn films are allowed to express is a fervent desire to be abused and degraded by their male sexual partners, which usually in these films number oftentimes in the dozens for one shoot. So, yeah, I mean, I think porn is a kind of emblematic of a kind of culture of death, of a kind of necrophilia masquerading as sex.
And maybe the flip side of that then is happiness studies, the illusion of happiness, the peddling, which you really connect to a kind of corporate brainwashing, the kind of peddling of the idea that all we have to do is think the right thoughts and we'll get what we want.
Yeah, well, that is, it's a whole industry, positive psychology, and there now University of Pennsylvania offers a master's degree in it, as does Claremont, a bunch of other places. But when you look at it, it is really about forcing people into a kind of cheerful conformity that, again, denies reality, any kind of grasping of reality that doesn't fit with a kind of happy, upbeat, positive image is dismissed as a form of negativity. You know, we don't want to hear it. And I think the fact that corporations constantly bring these positive psychologists in for corporate retreats and to work with employees is evidence of how I think brainwashing is probably the right word. You know, that any doubt or dissatisfaction or questioning of the corporate structure is boomeranged back on the employee as a kind of maladjustment on their part, that we are to find our happiness in the corporate whole. And it really is about the destruction of not only individual conscience, but even individual identity. There is a deeply totalitarian strain to the structure of corporations, as anyone who has worked in a corporation knows.
You talk about a guy at Kinko's, and this is a perfect example of the kind of totalitarian mindset you're talking about.
Yeah, well, this is was the story of a student named Anthony Vasquez. He's at the University of California. And one of the people that he worked with was fired. And yet his employers, and he knew because he was friends with the worker that he'd been fired, his employers put up, they never announced the dismissal, and they put up on the schedule that he was absent for work and then used that as grounds for removal. So after a couple weeks, Vasquez wrote fired in pencil under this guy's name on the schedule. And then he got hauled in, and he got a taste of sort of modern corporate management, which rather than overt coercion, uses these more sophisticated therapeutic forms of control and calls for group harmony to impose conformity. Now, this was a store where it's a FedEx Kinko's where, I mean, sort of ironically, this is before the election, the store's slogan was, "Yes, we can." Which meant that if a customer asked anyone in the store to do a job for them, no matter what it was, the employee had to immediately say, "Yes, we can." And there were posters of this slogan all over the store on telephones in the back room. And actually, corporate auditors would call up the store to make sure the employees were all saying, "Yes, we can." And anybody who didn't would be punished and even fired. So Vasquez gets called in to the store managers, and he gets reprimanded with what is known as a, quote, positive discipline documentation form. And what they charge him with is defacing company property for writing fired on the schedule. And he had to sign the document and leave the office. Now, not long after, he gets trotted off to one of these mandatory meetings for, you know, team members, which is what groups in the store called.
This is like re-education?
Yeah, this goes on in every corporation. So, I mean, this is just an example of, I mean, Kinko's, FedEx Kinko's is hardly alone. So they go off with these co-workers to Fresno, where they are grouped with workers from other stores. Somebody, this woman from corporate headquarters comes in with toys and candy and markers, and she organizes people according to the duration of their employment. Everybody has to say how long they were working. You know, they immediately sort of force strangers to open up on issues of privacy and vulnerability. So what happens is that through this meeting, well, of course, the undercurrent of the meeting is just how to push more merchandise and services onto the customers, which the term is upselling. She coordinated these groups to have people talk about positive customer service experience, and any kind of negative or stressful experiences were left unarticulated, so that happiness became not something that was caused by human interaction, but your interaction with the company itself. That you don't experience happiness because you're being social. You experience happiness because you work for FedEx, Kinko's. I mean, this is kind of the driving ideology of all corporate culture. And it is what's used to create this corporate collective. Again, it's an illusion. It's the illusion that all quotas can be met, that everything is possible, that profits can always be raised, that it all boils down to the right attitude, and that if these things don't happen, something is wrong with us. The highest form of personal happiness becomes when the corporation thrives. It's merging the self with the corporate collective.
Journalist Chris Hedges. We talked to him about his book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. He's also the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. Hedges is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and writes for, among others, Foreign Affairs, Harper's, the New York Review of Books, and Mother Jones. He's also a columnist for TruthDig.com. To hear Chris Hedges' reasons for hope, such as they are, for the end of illusion in American life, go to writersvoice.net for a web-only excerpt from our interview. Next up, Chris Pyle on secret government, war crimes, and the rule of law. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The U.S. used to be a refuge for people fleeing human rights threats from dictatorial regimes abroad. America held herself up as an example of respect for law and human rights. No more. Under the Bush administration, although it started earlier, human rights crimes like kidnapping, torture, and imprisonment without charges spread their stain on American policy and reputation. If you want to get a full picture of how the Bush torture policy was devised and executed, you need go no further than Chris Pyle's new book, Getting Away with Torture. Pyle knows a lot about how the U.S. government violates the rule of law. A former Army intelligence officer, in 1970 he blew the whistle on the military's domestic spying on civilians in the civil rights and anti-war movements. He served as an investigator on the Church Committee investigating the spying. That led to laws limiting domestic military surveillance, laws that were undermined under the Bush administration. Pyle is a constitutional scholar whose previous books include Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics and Extradition, Politics, and Human Rights. We talked to him about the latter in 2006. In Getting Away with Torture, he brings all the evidence together to paint a fascinating portrait of how the war on terror and the drive for revenge has undermined our basic civil freedoms. I sat down with Pyle at his home in South Hadley, Massachusetts. I started out by asking him why he says in Getting Away with Torture that the U.S. is no longer a constitutional government under law.
Because we have had a succession of presidents who have thought they were above the law.
that they could order their secret agents to do illegal actions and then to exempt them from prosecution for their crimes.
When you say series, who do you mean? Where did this start?
Well, it went back to at least the Nixon administration and perhaps earlier. It's really a post-World War II development as we've created a series of federal intelligence agencies, not just the CIA, but a lot of secret military operations and secret military intelligence agencies. And most recently, these have been involved in interrogation by torture. They've also been involved in kidnapping and a few instances of killings associated with interrogations and perhaps with the kidnappings.
I asked Chris Pyle to read a passage from the beginning of his book about Abu Ghraib. Let's start with probably where this all started for most Americans, and that is Abu Ghraib. That was what kind of put the idea of torture right on the table.
The day after the photographs were broadcast on CBS television, General James Mattis noticed a group of Marines huddled around a television outside a mess tent in El Asad, Iraq. "What's going on?" he asked the men. "Some assholes have just lost the war for us," a lance corporal replied. Few Americans were as quick as the corporal to comprehend the picture's significance, but General Mattis did. "When you lose the moral high ground," he explained later, "you lose it all."
When Abu Ghraib first happened, the president, Bush at that time, called it the work of bad apples, and he said that we do not torture. But your book lays out in very great detail that there was, in fact, a torture team. Tell us who were the major figures of that.
The policy was developed, I believe, primarily by Vice President Dick Cheney and his assistant, David Addington. They had the mandate, the portfolio, from Bush. Bush, however, was also involved in authorizing harsh interrogations, and he knew what was going on. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, issued written orders for harsh interrogation techniques that by American law constitute torture. The Central Intelligence Agency authorized it. And what is fascinating is how closely supervised the interrogators were by people like Rumsfeld or George Tenet, the CIA director, or their immediate subordinates. This was not something that went on out in the field by angry soldiers who had lost comrades. It was so closely supervised that lawyers were consulted to justify techniques which, under American law, had always been considered absolutely forbidden. They thought they could get information by torturing people. And they were right. You can get information. But most of it is false. And so they were torturing people, abusing people, humiliating people, more for their own reasons than for any practical purpose. The successful interrogations in the war against terrorism have been conducted by FBI agents using traditional interrogation techniques. The CIA, throughout these interrogations, and the military throughout these interrogations, were essentially incompetent.
Incompetent?
Incompetent. Flat out incompetent. Incapable of getting actionable intelligence in a timely fashion because they insisted on doing the very actions that would lead a person to resist the interrogation.
Could you give an example of that?
A fellow named Abu Zubaydah provided a great deal of useful information to FBI agents when he was being interrogated. Then the CIA was in a hurry, and so it took over the interrogations and got people in Washington to allow it to do so. And they started beating up on Abu Zubaydah. And he stopped cooperating. And he started giving false information.
Now, Dick Cheney has said, in recent months that, in fact, actionable intelligence was obtained through the use of what he calls enhanced techniques, and that, in fact, certain terrorist attacks were averted. What was your thought on that?
Well, the director of the FBI, Mr. Mueller, has said that he knows of no instance in which harsh interrogation techniques averted any kind of terrorist attack. The memoranda that the vice president cited as proof of his proposition have been released, and they do not support that assertion. The report of the Inspector General of the Central Intelligence Agency also does not support the vice president's claim that this interrogation worked. Yes, they got statements, but the statements could not be relied upon. Even if they were true, it would make no sense to rely on upon it, because you can't rely upon anything a tortured person gives you. I've been in the Army, and I would certainly not lead anybody into battle on the basis of information obtained by torture, and anybody who would should not be a combat arms officer.
The administration would not agree to abide by the Geneva Conventions because they said this was not a typical war. They call these enemy combatants. I wonder if you could lay out what is the difference between a so-called Geneva Convention war, where that obtains, and what they see this war as.
The Geneva Conventions say that all persons seized in the course of a war have certain basic minimal rights. And these basic minimal rights, which apply to civilians captured in war, were disregarded. And in fact, the instruction to disregard the Geneva Conventions essentially was a license to go out and do anything to the people you capture. And this is why there was so much military opposition, particularly from the Army lawyers. They knew, and some of the commanders, they knew that if you tell your troops that they're not bound by the Geneva Conventions, the troops will do terrible things all on their own. And a good deal of the abuse of these prisoners was gratuitous. It was not part of interrogations, and it certainly did not promote the gathering of information. Much of it was simply to satisfy superiors who demanded reports on the phone every night, wanting to know what was found. A good example of that is the CIA's interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Mm-hmm. Every day the CIA was on the phone to the field wanting to know what they had found out in the course of waterboarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They waterboarded him 183 times, each time authorized from Langley, Virginia, by the operations directorate of the CIA. And there's no question that waterboarding is torture. Mm-hmm. It's a criminal offense in the United States. A sheriff in Houston, near Houston, Texas, was sent to jail for waterboarding prisoners in 1985, while Attorney General Gonzalez was practicing law in that fair city. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew that case. It was in federal district court. That was a crime. And Gonzalez knew it was a crime. So too did Ashcroft. That's why they encouraged the president to suspend the Geneva Conventions, because they thought that if they suspended the Geneva Conventions, the criminal law would not apply. But of course, that is not true. And besides, they had no authority to suspend the Geneva Conventions, as the Supreme Court ruled in 2006. They deliberately chose to violate the criminal law with full knowledge they were violating the criminal law. And that is why I believe they should be prosecuted.
Yeah, you say at the end of the book that you feel that criminal prosecution is the way to go. But before we get to criminal prosecution, talk a little bit more on how there were other ways in which they sought to evade the law and to justify what they were doing, to claim a difference between this kind of war, these kinds of combatants, enemy combatants, the language, in other words, and the normal situation. What are some of the other steps they took?
Well, out in the field, they were making up new terms, and enemy combatant is one. It has no standing in American law. It did not at that time. But another term they used was persons under control, or PUKES for short. They felt that if they had captured someone who they thought was an enemy in this non-war war, that they could do anything to that person they wanted. And so at several military forward bases, they would just go into the tent and beat the person up with a baseball bat, and thought that was perfectly appropriate. And if somebody wanted to take out his aggressions on one of the prisoners, like a cook, the cook could go and whack at the prisoner. And they caused a lot of damage and pain to innocent people.
We're talking with Chris Pyle about his book, Getting Away with Torture, Secret Government, War Crimes, and the Rule of Law. There was an American who was involved, John Walker Lind. Remind us who he was and tell us what happened to him.
John Walker Lind was a kid from California who decided to convert to Islam, and he went to Afghanistan to study Islam, and while there was attracted by the Taliban to join in its war against the Northern Alliance. This was entirely a civil war within a foreign country. There was no crime for him to join in that. It was stupid, but it was no crime. But he had the misfortune of being out in the field, wandering around, when the United States allied itself with the warlords of the Northern Command. And then his unit surrendered to the Northern Command, and its particular warlord, Dostrom, who liked to kill people. And a lot of the people who surrendered were killed. Lind was not. He was out being interrogated inside a clay prison when there was a riot, and there was some fighting and some shooting. And the prisoners ended up fleeing to the basement of this prison. Down in that prison, they were in up to their armpits in water, and the warlord's people were pouring kerosene down into the basement and lighting it on fire. And very few people who were in that basement survived. But Lind did. He had never raised any war against the United States. But he survived and was turned over to the United States, which then proceeded to not treat his wound for 14 days. And they kept him in a steel shipping container, naked, taped to a stretcher, blindfolded, and they threatened him, and they put a blindfold over his face, and they wrote nasty words on the blindfold. And eventually, the Justice Department decided they wanted a show trial. They thought, this is a good example to show a kid who is a traitor to the United States and how we deal with traitors. So they brought him back to the United States, and they managed to persuade a friendly judge to schedule his trial for the first anniversary of 9/11. Which, of course, most judges would say is highly prejudicial. You don't do things like that. Faced with that threat, his lawyers negotiated a plea bargain, and he will be in prison for 20 years. He never attacked the United States. He never committed treason against the United States. But he has spent a good deal of time in a maximum security prison, far away from his family, among very brutal prisoners. And that's how we deal with kids who get caught up in foolish wars.
You say that on 9/25, and I assume that was 2001, on September 25th, you said that John Yoo told President Bush that he could attack any government or private organization anytime, anywhere, without the permission of Congress. So this is actually ranging much farther afield than just torture. Is there anything in American jurisprudence that would give the president that right?
No, absolutely not.
What was John Yoo's justification for this?
He just took the commander-in-chief clause as suggesting the president had unlimited power. And that's not what the founders intended. That's not what the Federalist Papers say. There are no reputable scholars I know who have ever taken that position. And when he wrote those memos, he did not acknowledge the work of reputable scholars. He just spun out his own idea. He didn't cite Supreme Court cases, which clearly limited executive power even in time of war.
Haven't there been other times of war, even such great presidents as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who took upon themselves, or now President Obama, who is claiming certain powers, such as the ability to continue renditions or to put people into preventive detention? So is there any place within American law for these for the executive to stand on in extraordinary circumstances to violate the Constitution in this way?
Not in American law. I used to work for Senator Sam Ervin, and he used to say that just because something is done before does not make it legal. He said that during Watergate. The executive branch would like us to believe that once it creates a few historic precedents of the president using military force when he probably should have gone to Congress, that that then says that Congress no longer has that authority in the Constitution. Well, presidents don't get to change the Constitution. Congress needs to reclaim its authority. The courts need to begin to push Congress in that direction. Because we're getting into the very bad habit of presidents initiating military operations whenever they feel like it. We have presidents who manipulate secret intelligence to stampede Congress. And we have Congresses that don't have what it takes to stand up to that. And I deal with this in the book. The serious problem of lack of congressional oversight and skepticism is responsible for much of this torture. What has happened is that members of Congress are sent to Washington by their constituents to get money for the districts. That's the chief function of a congressman, to get money for his donors in the district and for his constituents in the district. That's what they care about. Much of that money is dispensed by the executive branch, according to large appropriations granted to the executive branch. Members of Congress become supplicants to the president for that money. They're beggars. They go with their tin cup in hand to the executive branch to get money for their districts. As a result, they do not want to do anything that might irritate the executive branch. And so they tend not to check and balance as the founders expected that they would.
So is this an explanation for why Democratic Congresses have tended not to stand up to Republican ones?
Yes, they're on the dole. And because the federal government dispenses so much money in so many different ways, particularly in the last 8 months, I mean, Congress has been in an orgy of spending money. They've never had so much fun. Well, if you're so busy dispensing the next generation's taxes, then you're not likely to check and balance and question the current president, whichever party he belongs to.
Chris Pyle says the roots of habeas corpus and Anglo-American law go back to the 13th century. Habeas corpus declares the right to challenge the legality of indefinite detention by the executive. It can be suspended under the U.S. Constitution, but only under very restrictive circumstances, and only by the Congress.
If we are in a battlefield situation here in the United States because of an invasion or rebellion, then yes, Congress may authorize the president to arbitrarily detain people. But the important thing to note is that it is Congress that authorizes it, not the executive. And that's been quite clearly established by the courts.
Now, I'm puzzled because President Obama is also a constitutional lawyer. How does he claim that he has the right for preventive detention, as he has done so recently? At least that's what it seems to me.
I don't think he has asserted executive power for preventive detention, except so far as he's continued preventive detention. To that extent, yes, he is exceeding his authority. He has some assistants who are putting together a bill, at least claimed to be, that would authorize preventive detention. But that would have to be enacted by Congress.
So you said before in this interview that there needed to be criminal prosecution of those who put together the torture policy under President Bush. We just mentioned that President Obama is possibly putting together a bill that would, where he asked to enact into law some of those very same policies. I wonder if you could stitch these two things together. Talk to us about why do you feel it is necessary to bring criminal prosecution against those in the Bush administration who did this. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind how President Obama has said that we need to let the past lie, basically, and not go after these folks. So why do you want that kind of criminal prosecution?
We have had too many presidents and too many presidential aides, Watergate, Iran-Contra, and now the torture controversy, believing that they can commit crimes with impunity. And if Obama refuses to prosecute these people, he will have endorsed the proposition, the Bush proposition, The presidents are above the law, and they can order secret agents to kidnap, torture, detain, humiliate, and abuse people. Not just foreigners, but also Americans, because they did it to Americans as well. We cannot afford that. If we have that proposition established as American law, then we have returned to the government of James I. James I asserted the power to suspend the laws on his own, and he asserted the power to excuse his agents from the application of the criminal law whenever he wished. Those are called the suspension power and the dispensation power. They were forbidden by British law in 1689 in the famous Declaration of Rights, which was the model for our Bill of Rights. And the framers knew that. And they thought it was so well established, they didn't bother to write it into the Constitution. No chief executive has the power to suspend the law. That's what the suspension clause clearly says. You don't have that power. Now, Obama is saying he has that power. He went to the CIA headquarters, and he told them that I will not prosecute you, or I will not have my administration prosecute you, if you thought you were, in good faith, obeying the secret legal memoranda by John Yoo that said you could go ahead and torture people.
Well, Chris Beile, you know, we've talked before about this issue, and I remember the last time that I came here and we're sitting in your lovely library here, that you talked to me about the secret government of the United States. So you are talking on the one hand here that no president has a right to suspend the law. I'd like to read back to you a quote that you have in your book, Getting Away with Torture. This was a conversation where Clinton and President Clinton and Vice President Gore were together. And Gore said about something, I believe rendition, it was about rendition. Of course it's a violation of international law, he was answering somebody. That's why it's covert. So is that right? Are covert institutions supposed to be above the law, and that's in fact why they're covert?
Well, our Congress has never actually authorized covert operations. This has been something that's come from executive interpretation of the National Security Act of 1947. Gore is not citing law. He's citing the novels of James Bond. And we have a culture in our society where we believe that certain government agents have license to kill for king and country. We're getting a president who's looking very much like a Stuart King, who can secretly authorize, as Bush did, secret prisons abroad, interrogations that can lead to death, attacks that are essentially assassination attacks. And he can do this, according to John Yoo, in the United States as well as in other countries. And people thrilled to the idea that somebody would have the courage to break the law in order to save America. That's the ethic of this crowd. Well, they don't save America. They simply create more enemies for America, massively more enemies. These people, by their foolishness and by their lack of interrogation skills, by their misunderstanding of what good intelligence requires, have endangered the lives of thousands of American servicemen and American civilians and foreigners all around the world, because these people hate the United States. They see the United States as the world's leading hypocrite, and we are.
Well, Chris Beile, your book is Getting Away with Torture. It is a fascinating book. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Chris Beile teaches constitutional law at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. You can listen to all our shows, plus find out much more about our guests and their books at writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.